Thanks for coming. So today I'm going to talk about a mathematical program to classify the gates of the Clifford hierarchy, which is something that was defined 25 years ago and is still under active study. And essentially, I mean, Clifford hierarchy, maybe it's a bit of a red herring, really we're interested in magic states and the teleportation protocols. Okay, so just to set up the general setting, we're going to be talking about fault-tolerant quantum computation, which is the theory of how do we make quantum computers work in the real world, okay, where we don't assume that everything works like math, okay, there are problems with hardware, they might make mistakes, and we want to be able to compute in the face of these errors, correct for them, and not make any assumptions that are unrealistic. So that has its own mathematical theory. It's also a very nice theory for studying quantum advantage, one of the themes of this meeting, because the model of fault-tolerant quantum computing, the dominant model, factorizes nicely into a class of easy operations, which are then must be supplemented with these magic states, which are like resources in the sense that without them we have, you know, sub-universal power, and then somehow access to these resources, they get used up by this protocol, and the result is, quantum advantage. Okay, so we're interested in getting a deeper understanding of the structure of these magic states and how much advantage they give so that we can correlate it with other things that we think, you know, are underlying the provision of this advantage. Okay, everything I'll be talking about is in the higher dimensional qubit setting, okay, so not over qubits, over qudits. So there's two reasons why we're interested in qudits. One reason is practical, which is that there's work on magic state escalation, for example, by Hussein Anwar, Dan Brown, and Earl Campbell, showing that magic state escalation is vastly more efficient in qudit settings, like potentially by orders of magnitude. And because magic state distillation is like the primary bottleneck in terms of hardware of building a quantum computer, that might actually be essential one day to building large-scale fault-tolerant quantum computers. The theoretical reason is that we shouldn't consider results that are established only in the qubit setting as being things that we can say hold generally true about quantum computing, right? Because facts about moral lessons about quantum computing shouldn't be dimension-specific. Okay, so I'll be extending some results to the qubit setting, and also because I should mention from the jump, since this is a interdisciplinary conference, this is a work of mathematical physics, which puts a lot of emphasis on proving things in the greatest generality possible, and also introducing new and novel mathematical tools and techniques. So that's a large aspect of this work, is that by extending things to infinitely many qubit dimensions, we necessarily have to develop new interesting tools. Okay. Oh, and by the way, feel free to interrupt with questions. Okay. Yeah, so to give an overview, I'm just going to very quickly review quantum error correction fault tolerance. I'll talk about the teleportation, and specifically its variant, the gate teleportation protocol, which is used to achieve universal quantum computing in the fault tolerant model. I'll give a bit of mathematical background about the results that I'll be presenting. So I won't give a technical statement right now, but basically the results boil down to giving more efficient protocols for the key operations of quantum computing that we need to achieve universality. And also go towards, as I mentioned, classifying the resources that drive quantum computing, which is necessary if we want a better structural understanding of quantum advantage in concrete models. Okay? And also, yeah, some of the novel mathematical methods that are necessary to establish these results. So the tools we'll be using are linear algebra, okay, obvious, because everything in quantum mechanics is in terms of linear algebra, abstract algebra, but what's novel is the use of algebraic geometry. So we'll be using some tools that haven't really been applied within quantum information yet. Okay, so I should mention that I will be in the background. I'll talk about some work I did in 2020 that sets up a framework. But mostly, I'll be talking about some joint work with Imin Chen, who is a number theorist at SFU. So he primarily works on things like Fermat's Last Theorem. But thankfully, he helped me solve this problem that was bugging me for a long time. And if we have time, I'll mention some forthcoming work with Oscar Lauch, undergrad student who's in the audience here, and some similar joint work with Rui and Angelos, who are in Portugal right now. Okay. Okay, so yeah, very brief review of error correction fault tolerance. Okay, so classical computers, they also have error correction built into them, and you can protect errors using redundancy. For example, if you have a bit and you want to encode, say, a zero, you can just copy it three times. So if a bit flip occurs, we can just take a majority vote and recover our bit. Okay. Unfortunately, we cannot do this for quantum data because of the no cloning theorem, so we can't just copy our qubits to protect it against noise. This seemed like it might be fatal, so when Shor came out with his algorithm, the reception from the physics community, from, I'm told I was in primary school at the time, was, this is amazing, it's just too bad we'll never build these devices because noises are fatal and we can't protect our data. So Shor basically invented the beginnings of error correction in response to this. Okay, so it turns out that in spite of the null cloning theorem, we can still encode data into a larger physical system and introduce some redundancy. So here's the simplest example. So here we have some qubit that we want to protect. So all we do is use these C0s to kind of copy it, okay? But notice that we're not actually copying it, right? Because if we copied it, we'd be taking a threefold tensor product, so there'd be a bunch of cross terms. So this is, in a sense, kind of a classical copy, but this is essentially enough to protect our data, okay? But the problem is, unlike in the classical case, we can't just look at our data and see if it's being corrupted, like, for example, with a majority vote, okay? That's another big problem of trying to correct errors in the quantum setting. We can't peek at encoded data without destroying it via measurement collapse. So the other incredible innovation in quantum error correction is to not ask what is the data to see how it's been corrupted, but to only ask the question, how has the data been corrupted? Okay, and by gaining no information about what the data is, just what the error is, the data is perfectly preserved, but we get information about the error, and then we can apply the appropriate corrections. Okay. So I just gave on the previous slide the circuit for encoding logical data into, sorry, our raw data into its protected encoded form. And we also have to be able to apply gates to this data in the encoded form, because we don't want to keep encoding it and decoding it every time we want to apply a gate, because that risks introducing errors. Okay, so in this fault-tolerant realistic setting, everything we do could introduce errors, including encoding. So we want to be able to compute directly on the data. And the ideal way of doing this is what's called transversely. So say suppose we wanted to do this gate on our logical data. The best way we can do it, so for example, this qubit has been tripled via the previous circuit, and same with this qubit. We want to apply a gate involving both. The best way to do it is if we can do it pairwise, just apply the same gate pairwise across the three qubits. And the reason why this is optimal is because it doesn't spread errors. So if there's an error on here, then it only spreads down to one qubit rather than everything in this block, which means that errors don't accumulate fast enough that we can't suppress them in time, okay? So this is kind of the best way to be able to do gates fault-tolerantly, okay? Which means in a way where we don't assume that we can do them perfectly but can still suppress the errors. Okay, unfortunately, not all gates can be performed transversely. So necessarily, there's some set of easy gates that we can do, but we can't do every gate this way. So I'll talk about what are the easy gates within the setting of stabilizer codes, which are basically every code of interest that we use to encode quantum data. So in the qubit setting, recall that the basic Pauli gates, Z and X, you know, they generalize the qubit Z and X, but instead of being 1 and negative 1, we choose the dth primitive roots of unity, and for the z, we just put the different roots of unity along the diagonal, and x is the shift operator, okay? Just like in the qubit case. But more important than the actual matrices themselves, I want to argue that actually the algebraic relations that they satisfy are a more important characterization of them. So specifically, they're of order d, and you can pull the z past the x by introducing this omega, okay? So just like in the qubit case, where omega would be negative 1. Okay, so this is basically all we need to know about Pauli gates. So these are the basic Pauli gates on one qubit, but we can also define more general Pauli gates on n qubits. So by specifying a dit string, so 2n numbers mod d, okay, which here is p and q. P is n dits and d is qubits. Sorry, q is n dits, right? Then we can specify a more general Pauli just by taking powers of the basic Paulis and taking the tensor product across the different qubits. Okay, so basically what's important to know is that there's a bunch more Paulis, but they're all described by the simple discrete data. Rather than taking the exponentially sized matrices, we just talk about the polynomially sized dit strings that specify them. Okay, and we have this nice symplectic structure on the strings that describe the Paulis. So this symplectic inner product here basically just counts how many times you're commuting z's past x's, so it actually characterizes a commutation relation between these more general polys. Okay, and specifically they commute if and only if the Sobolevsky inner product between the distrings vanish. Okay. And so we can define the group of Pauli gates by just closing under phase, so introducing all the possible primitive root of unity phases. Okay? So the Pauli gates are the basis of stabilizer codes in the sense that quantum data is encoded using certain eigenvectors of Pauli gates. These are the stabilizer states, right? So you just take maximal abelian subgroups of the group of Pauli gates, and they're going to define some stabilizer states, and those are what we use to encode our quantum data in a stabilizer code. Okay, so the question is, which gates can be easily performed Faltonically, for example, transversely? Not necessarily transversely depending on the code, but some other easy implementation. And typically, the answer for any stabilizer code is going to be the group of Clifford gates. Okay? And the group of Clifford gates, you know, you're familiar with it. It's defined as those gates which, when you conjugate a Pauli, you get back a Pauli. Okay? So I've, I forgot to mention this, but I've denoted the Pauli gates, the group of Pauli gates by C1, and the Clifford gates by C2, okay, just to hint at what's coming. The group of Clifford gates conjugate Paulis to Paulis. So in group theoretic language, we're just saying that it's the normalizer of the Pauli group as a subgroup of the unitary group. Okay, so these are also you know, exponentially sized matrices, but because they preserve Paulis, which are each specified by this discrete DIT string, they also have a very nice simple discrete description. So if we mod out by the phase, right, then it has a simple discrete group structure, which is the group of affine symplectic linear transformations on ZD to the 2n. Okay, so this is basically telling you if you conjugate a Pauli by a Clifford, if that Pauli is described by this DIT string, then you just transform that DIT string according to the symplectic affine transformation. So it's symplectic because it preserves the commutation relation, right? So therefore, we know that it's symplectic, it preserves that symplectic form. Okay, any questions? Okay, so the main point is that Paulis and Cliffords both have this simple discrete description in terms of polynomially sized objects with integers mod d. Okay, the problem with the Cliffords, even though they can be easily performed transversely on stabilizer codes, or sorry, not transversely, easily, usually transversely, is that it's maximal, a maximal non-dense subgroup of the unitaries. So because it's non-dense, that means that we can't do universal quantum computing because there are some gates that can't be achieved by approximately, to arbitrary approximation by just composing Cliffords. But it's maximal with respect to this property. So if we add in any single gate outside that group, we can generate a dense subgroup and therefore achieve universal quantum computing. Okay, so in order to fault-tolerantly, we need to be able to fault-tolerantly perform a non-Clifford gate to achieve fault-tolerant universal quantum computing. Okay, so the method for how you do that was invented by Gottesman Chuang like 25 years ago, and basically they built upon the quantum teleportation protocol that was you know, even earlier, and that result was more quantum foundation results, but found practical application. So I don't really have to review quantum teleportation here, I guess. But basically, remember, Alice has some state that she wants to send to Bob. So in preparation for, and they don't want to send quantum data during the protocol. Okay, so they, in advance of knowing that they want to do this, they prepare a Bell state, share one half of it each. Alice performs a Bell measurement on her half, gets a measurement outcome, and Bob's half is now the state that Alice wanted to send up to some Pauli correction, which is based, which corresponds to the measurement outcomes that Alice got with her Bell measurement. So Alice sends Bob the classical outcomes to her measurement. Bob can then perform a Pauli correction and therefore has recovered the state that Alice meant to send. Okay, so this can be adapted to perform gates basically by changing the starting state that they, the entangled state that they share, so that at the end, Bob doesn't have psi, but has psi with some gate applied to it. And the point is that the gate is something that we can do, that we can't do fault-tolerantly in the normal way, but we can do using this gate teleportation protocol. Okay, so here is the normal teleportation protocol in circuit form. So this stage is the preparation of the shared Bell state. Here is Alice's Bell measurement on the state she wants to send and her half of the Bell pair. And here is the Pauli correction. Okay, so we can adapt this very easily, very slightly. So all I've done here is I've introduced G and G star, which is just the identity, so it doesn't change the circuit at all. Okay, and I've added a G at the end. Okay, so notice, right? All I've done is add G and G star, and then G at the end. Okay, so then I've put these in their boxes suggestively. Okay, so what the G and G star does, well, it does nothing, right? Because the identity, the G at the end means that Bob's final state is not psi, but G of psi. Okay, and I've moved the additions into the different stages so that we can think of this stage as preparing not the shared Bell state, but sharing this magic state. Okay, so as long as Alice and Bob prepare this this magic state, which is now G applied to 1/2 of a Bell pair, then everything else in this, and as long as they can perform everything else in this protocol fault-tolerantly, then the whole protocol is fault-tolerant. Okay, so this motivates the definition of the third level gate, which is something that conjugates a Pauli to a Clifford. So the reason why this definition is important is that this Pauli correction gets conjugated by G in this gate teleportation protocol. So as long as this whole conjugation is Clifford, then that means this can be done fault-tolerantly, this can be done fault-tolerantly. So we've now reduced fault-tolerantly performing G down to fault-tolerantly performing preparing this state, which also can be done. Okay, so that motivates the definition of third level, because now we've if a gate is in the third level but not Clifford, then we can perform it with this protocol where everything is fault tolerant, okay? And we've just reduced it down to preparing this magic state, right? Right. So we can also define higher levels of the Clifford hierarchy inductively, which are gates that conjugate G to conjugate the Paulis to one level down, because the reason why this is interesting is that if we've now gained the ability to apply third level gates fault-tolerantly using this protocol, we can then perform more gates fault-tolerantly, those in the fourth level, right? Because now this correction operator will be a third level gate, which we can then do using the same protocol for the third level, okay? So this defines a nested sequence of gates. So the first level is the Paulis, second level is the Cliffords, and the third level is defined as above, and yeah, it's a nested sequence, so they just get bigger and bigger. The first two levels are groups, and then no longer are groups. But yeah, the essential point is that if you can do a gate that's in the third level, subtract the second level, then that is going to get you universality. Okay, and you can also perform gates. You can also achieve universality using gates in the higher levels, as long as you can also do ones in the lower level. Okay. Right. So this original protocol is based on gate teleportation, which, as I mentioned, was originally invented, you know, as a foundational result, basically by saying, how weird is quantum mechanics? Look, you can send quantum data, right? So part of this, one feature of this protocol is that there's no, after you prepare the Bell state, there's no interaction between Alice's lines and Bob's lines, right? But that's not necessary in a quantum computer, right? Because they're all living on the same chip. So we don't actually need this to use this teleportation protocol if we're using it for computation. So you can actually compactify this gate teleportation protocol in the case where, for certain gates, okay? So notice here that the magic state has twice as many qubits as the actual gate you want to perform. But there is a compact teleportation protocol for certain what are called semi-Clifford gates, which are diagonal up to a Clifford, which means that if you multiply on the, they're basically are diagonal up to multiplication on the left and right by potentially different Cliffords. So if a gate in the Clifford hierarchy has this special form, then you can use this compactified teleportation protocol. This is the Q-did version, where the magic state has the same size as the gate you want to perform. That is half the size in the standard protocol. And this is really important because you have to do maybe millions of these gates if you want to do a typical computation. So if you cut it down by half, that's a pretty significant savings. Okay, so just to recap, the Pauli group are the gates C1 that are built from Z and X. The Clifford group are those gates that can easily be performed fault-tolerantly. However, there's not enough because it's not a universal set. So we need third level and potentially higher level gates that can be fault-tolerantly performed with access to suitable magic states. And semi-Clifford gates are kind of the best ones because they can be performed with these efficient magic states. So two natural questions that arise are, well, what are the gates of the Clifford hierarchy? Can we classify them? and which of them are semi-Clifford, okay? Because we want to know which ones we can do efficiently. So this has been studied, as I mentioned, like over the past 25 years. So I'll just quickly review some of the known results in the qubit case. So for one or two qubit gates, all gates of the Clifford hierarchy are semi-Clifford. However, for higher numbers of qubits, this starts to break down. Basically, this graph, it's black when the result is true that all gates of that many qubits of that level are always semi-Clifford, and white if it's not. So for third level of three qubits, it is true that they're all semi-Clifford, but then for beyond that, it's not true. There are counterexamples. Okay, so it does depend on the number of qubits and the level. I also mentioned that this proof is done using exhaustive computations. So there's not much, you know, it's basically they ran a computer program to check everything. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a way to approach this in a more analytic mathematical way, how to study the Clifford hierarchy. And the key tool is the Stone von Neumann theorem, which is a foundational result originally designed to unify the matrix and wave mechanic pictures of quantum theory. So at that time, there were two seemingly completely distinct mathematical formalisms for quantum theory, and everyone was confused as to why they were giving the same answers and which one was correct. And it turns out they're the same. And basically what it says is that any two representations of the canonical commutation relations are unitarily equivalent. So even though they look mathematically different, they're actually giving the same theory. And as it turns out, this is perfectly suited to systematically studying the Clifford hierarchy. So this is like an observation I made in this 2020 paper, although Bezier-Shor had a similar observation in the case of qubit gates of the third level. But it turns out you can fruitfully extend this to higher levels and qubits. Okay, so basically, so the Stone von Neumann theorem has lots of versions and variants, you know, like continuous versions and all kinds of interesting representation theory. We only need this very simple discrete form, which says that if you have two unitaries that are both order d and they have this commutation relation, that means they must be rotations of z and x by some gate g. Okay, so it's, one way is obvious, right? If you take g and conjugate z and x, then obviously they look like this, but this is saying that the converse is true. Everything that satisfies these relations also comes from some gate g. Okay, so what this gives is a bijection between unitaries g and pairs uv that satisfy this relation. Okay, so you might think, what's the point of this? Why are we studying a gate g in terms of two unitaries, right? But it turns out this is a natural way to study the Clifford hierarchy because of this theorem, which is that a gate is kth level if and only if its conjugates of z and x generate k minus 1th level gates. So if you want to study the kth level, then you can reduce it down to studying the lower level using this theorem. So basically, you can do all your proofs inductively using this technique. So, so using basically this basic idea, it turns out you can get a lot of information about the Clifford hierarchy. So for example, you can write an algorithm for generating the entire Clifford hierarchy. So previously in the literature, they were just read, like scattered examples, but you can actually give an exhaustive list of every gate in the Clifford hierarchy. It's also useful as a mathematical tool for classifying results because you can classify lower levels and use that to bootstrap up to higher levels. You get a nice description of semi-Clifford gates. So that description I gave you earlier in terms of left, multiplying on the left and right by Cliffords, it's kind of hard to work with because you would have to quantify overall C1 and C2 to check if something is Clifford, but actually you can use this theorem to get a much nicer both algorithm and analytic criterion for recognizing and diagonalizing semi-Clifford gates, so that'll come in later. I also use it to prove that all third level gates of one qubit, so this holds for all dimensions, is semi-Clifford. Then I proved for all third level gates of two qutrits are semi-Clifford. So basically I had to restrict myself to d equals 3 because this proof, like the original proof in the qubit case, used exhaustive computation. And so only the d equals 3 case is tractable because at that stage the math was too hard to be able to prove it analytically. But basically what I'm going to be talking about is how do you actually prove this for all dimensions and what kind of math is involved. And it turns out you have to use algebraic geometry. Okay, so I'm not going to really get too deep into what algebraic geometry is, but the idea is to study algebra via geometry and vice versa. So this goes back to, you know, to the Greeks, I guess, and Descartes. And there's much, much more super advanced modern forms that I honestly don't fully understand, which is why I was very happy that Imin was willing to work with me. Basically, So the idea is, you know, we all seen the parabola. This is a geometric shape and an equation, and information about the shape and the equation, you know, can go back and forth between them. Here's a more complicated shape. That's the solution to a quintic in three variables. And the idea is to study the space of solutions to a family of polynomial equations. So that requires the algebra, which are the equations, and the geometry, which is the space of solutions. And essentially, the most important theorem, central theorem, is Hilbert's Null-Stellensatz, which sets up a bijection between radical ideals of certain polynomial rings and algebraic sets, which is the solutions to those families of polynomials in the ideal. Okay? Right, so I'll talk about how we proved this result, which is that, yeah, basically showing that every two-qubit third-level gate is semi-Clifford for odd prime dimension D. So the key thing here is that D, there's infinitely many Ds, right? So that's why we require this this level of mathematical abstraction. And so the proof strategy is, and the way that the way algebraic geometry is going to come in is that we're going to characterize what it means to be third level and what it means to be semi-Clifford, both in terms of families of polynomial equations. So each of those give rise to two different shapes. And you can just think of them as being the shape of third level gates and the shape of semi-Clifford gates. And we want to show that those two shapes coincide. Okay, so it turns out it's very helpful to move back and forth between algebraic and geometric reasoning. Yeah, so the proof strategy is to characterize third level gates and semi-Clifford third level gates using polynomial equations over ZD. Okay, so it may not seem obvious that we're able to do that because both of these are defined in terms of unitaries of complex numbers, but that's where it comes in that they have these nice descriptions over ZD, bit strings for Paulis and symplectic matrices, affine transformations for third level gate, for Clifford, sorry. What we want to show is that for every dimension D, that these two sets of solutions coincide. In order to treat D with one calculation rather than a different calculation for every D, we need to invoke the theory of schemes, okay, which goes back to Grothendieck and was introduced to basically modernize algebraic geometry. The main idea about schemes, I'm not going to really get into the definition because it would take a long time, but the idea is that all those shapes I showed you before, the parabola, whatever, all those variables were over, you know, nice continuous fields, but using schemes you can change those things to not even fields, but like any commutative ring, okay? So basically allows you to use this, build a shape of solutions where instead of the solutions being reals or complex, they can be like in ZD, okay? Which is a very weird shape. It's like not even continuous. They're kind of basically really hard to imagine. Okay, so so now we'll talk about how we go through these steps, okay? So the first step is to, I should mention that algebraic set is just a name for this kind of shape that arises as a solution to a family of polynomial equations. Okay, so the first step is to build our algebraic set or shape that corresponds to third level gates. So the way we do that is, like, say, suppose we have G and some third level gate, which means that it conjugates every Pauli to a Clifford. Okay, so that means that if we conjugate all these basic Paulis, Z tensor I, X tensor I tensor Z, I tensor X, we're going to get four Cliffords. Okay, and the point of the Stone-Voigt Neumann theorem is that these four Cliffords determine G. Okay, so there's an equivalent description of G. And being Cliffords, they have nice discrete descriptions in terms of symplectic matrices. Okay, and even more, we can reduce it down to the case where they all have symplectic matrices that are, all have a very nice form, which means that without loss of generality, all of these four Cliffords are actually determined by a 2x2 symmetric matrix, which basically determines a diagonal Clifford and a Pauli. Okay, and the reason we're able to make this reduction, we have to use this classification of the abelian subgroups of the D-Thielo subgroups of the symplectic matrices. Okay, so basically a kind of old result about the classical groups. Okay, this guy did this in his thesis, so I had to email him to ask him some clarifications, and I think he's retired now, but he seemed pretty happy that people are still applying his dissertation to quantum information. Okay, so, yeah, so basically the point is that G, which is a third level gate, produces for you a bunch of numbers in D. And that also determines, so basically there's a correspondence between third level gates and certain strings of dits. Okay? But which dits, which strings actually correspond to third level gates? So those we characterize using polynomial equations. Right? So don't worry about what these actually mean. I mean, they're pretty complicated polynomial equations. But basically, as I mentioned, these determine G. Right? So what we want is to come up with a bunch of numbers that that determine Cliffords, but we also need those Cliffords to have the right commutation relations. Right? So we need those Cliffords to have order D, and we need them to, you know, when you commute them past each other, they get omega if they're on the same qdit, and they commute if they're on different qdits, and that's exactly what these polynomial equations are encoding. Okay, so these polynomial equations are enforcing that the dit strings that describe our Cliffords obey the commutation relations. Okay, so basically there's a correspondence between classes of third level gates and solutions to this extremely complex system of polynomial equations. So that's our first algebraic set. The second thing we need to do is also characterize semi-Cliffordness as a polynomial system. Okay, so it's not so obvious again that you can do that because the original definition is in terms of multiplying on the left and right by these Cliffords. But yeah, I won't get into how we do that, but yeah, you can also give a family of polynomial equations so that if a bunch of numbers that are a solution to the previous equation, set of equations, determine a third level gate, if they also satisfy these set of equations, they're a semi-Clifford, which means that they have these efficient magic states in teleportation protocols. Okay, so basically what we want to show is that this set of equations follows from that set of equations. And it turns out it's actually easy to do this at the geometric level. So forget about the fact that we're doing this for all D now. If we're trying to do this for a fixed D, then using Hilbert's null Stellensatz, then all we need to check is that the two radical ideals that correspond to these two algebraic sets are the same, okay? Because that will tell us that these two sets of gates are the same. But that's for a fixed D, okay? The problem is that this is actually quite easy to do with a computer. You can use Magma or some other computer algebra system to check this using Grobner bases. But the problem is that in principle, you would need a different calculation for every D because you have to fix your ring when you ask it to do a computation. So what we're going to do to treat all dimensions at once is to construct two schemes. So instead of having an algebraic set for third level gates and semi-Clifford gates, we're going to have this more general kind of shape. And the point of schemes is that we can, if we show that they're equivalent, we can reduce the modulo D to check that their corresponding algebraic sets also coincide. So basically, we're just going to lift it up to the very high level, to a very abstract shape, show that these shapes correspond, coincide, which means that when we reduce them for any dimension, that we get the theorem for every fixed D. Right, so as I mentioned, that's kind of the theoretical justification for the calculation that we do. So this calculation can also be done using a computer algebra system in principle. Right? The problem is that, as I mentioned, those polynomial equations systems are extraordinarily complicated, and they involve quite a few variables. So yeah, in practice, you can't just plug in these equations into a computer and ask it to do it for you. So we actually have to do a bunch more theory in order to simplify it down to some equations that we can actually check with the computer. So for example, here is that first set of equations that characterize third level gates, right, that tell you when the Cliffords that they conjugate the Paulis to have the right commutation relations. So this is what it looks like when written somewhat suggestively that in a way that looks like a linear system, okay? But it's actually not a linear system because this side involves quadratic terms, okay? But in order to simplify the system, what we're gonna do is instead of asking for a bunch of variables that satisfy this equation, we're gonna ask for some variables that render it consistent. So we're weakening the system of equations. Right, so what that does is, if we just ask for consistency of this system, we're eliminating the actual variables pi, so we're reducing the number of variables by a bunch, because these pi's are vectors, actually. But the cost is that we're enlarging our algebraic sets, so we run the risk that even when we check that they're the same, or they may not be the same anymore, right, because we're changing our system of equations. So once we make a bunch of simplifications, we can actually do the computations, it renders them feasible, but it might not show what we want to show because we actually changed our system. So basically the last step is to show that adding these simplifications, we still get the result. So for example, when we enlarge our shapes that correspond to third level gates, we have to show that the new components that are added, so basically what happens when we weaken the system is we add some new blobs to the shape, okay, and some of the old blobs get larger, but we have to show that these new solutions are actually extraneous. They don't actually correspond to third level gates. And all that reasoning put together gives us the result, because we basically showed that the schemes corresponding to third level and semi-Clifford gates are the same, okay? So I have 5 minutes, so I'll just briefly mention some forthcoming work. This work is joint work with Oscar, who's here, who's an undergrad USRA student. So we did this last summer, we're continuing it this summer. So we're trying to go beyond the third level. So in a sense, the third level is kind of the optimal case because they are kind of the best magic states, but we're also interested in extending this result to generalize what's known in the qubit case to show that all two qubit hierarchy gates for any level are semi-Clifford. And the way that we're going to do this is to try to use a purely algebraic approach, so not try to rely on characterizing things as polynomials and use some computer algebra techniques, but to try to just use the algebra of the Clifford group. So that requires basically developing some deeper structure theorems about the Clifford group in order to make this work. So we kind of have to learn a bit more about the qubit Clifford group in order for this strategy to work. So one example of this deeper understanding of the structure is this normal form for single qubit Clifford gates, where you can write any single qubit Clifford as a product of a diagonal Clifford, a permutation Clifford, and M, okay, where M is either the identity or the Hadamard times some fixed diagonal Clifford. And so far, what we managed to get is that single qubit gates of any level of the Clifford hierarchy are semi-Clifford. Okay, so this is the case of one qubit, but what's different from all the previous results, at least for the qubit case, is that it works for any level of the Clifford hierarchy. So that shows that there's some promise to this approach. Okay, so another area of kind of related to this work is joint work with Angelos Bampounis and Rui Barbosa, where we're basically studying, so everything I mentioned was talking about the canonical computation relations, right? That's the basis of stabilizer theory, but we can also kind of play a similar game with the canonical anti-commutation relations, which model non-interacting fermions. That is the match gate formalism, which gives us an alternative factorization of quantum gates into easy and hard gates. Yeah, so we basically are defining an analogous match gate hierarchy, and the reason why you'd be interested in this is that it yields new families of magic states and gate teleportation protocols, and also, yeah, generally helps with understanding of quantum advantage by, you know, developing understanding of all the resources in a new theory that complements the stabilizer theory. For example, we can give ranks on the resourcefulness of magic states, and that's useful for understanding quantum advantage. Okay, so just to summarize the significance of the results, we get more efficient paths to achieving universal quantum computation. So everything, of course, everything now is kind of based on Clifford plus T, so we have a single fixed third level gate. So it might be interesting to ask, okay, now we know that we have all these other alternatives to the T gate, maybe we can shorten circuit compilation or gate synthesis by using, rather than only synthesizing things with T, maybe it's easier to directly implement some of these alternative paths that also have efficient magic states. We get a deeper structural understanding of the magic states that are relevant to the theoretical study of quantum advantage. And also, as I mentioned, a big motivation for me is that it's the first application of this new set of mathematical tools to quantum information. And I would argue that this blueprint could be applied to many other questions in quantum error correction, because they all kind of use the same idea. They're all built on the Heisenberg-Weil group. So if you can characterize conditions in terms of polynomial equations, you can use similar methods to also solve these things in infinitely many dimensions. And I got to the end of the talk without ever mentioning contextuality, which, given my scheduling, I think maybe I should. So I'll just mention this corollary. In 2018, I proved this result about magic states, about strong contextuality of certain magic states that builds on Howard's result, which shows that probabilistic contextuality is necessary for distillability. So trying to argue that the logical structure of contextuality is relevant to its ability to provide advantage, I prove that resourcefully optimal, two Q the magic states are strongly contextual. Okay, so I didn't know this at the time, but this kind of strengthens this result because what I meant by resourcefully optimal is that they injected diagonal third level gates. And now with this result, it turns out that these magic states actually inject any third level gate. Okay, so yep, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Nish. Very interesting. Questions? Oh, maybe I'll start. So why only odd primes so far?
Because of the symplectic description of Clifford gates. So like in order to describe the Clifford group as this, like as symplectic linear transformations, like it's just easier to stick to odd prime.
Sure. Like for example, square free dimension, like odd square free.
Yeah, I think you could probably extend it to more dimensions, like as you mentioned. But yeah, I just haven't done that yet because, I mean, the key thing was to try and get it to infinitely many dimensions. But yeah, I guess you could also play potentially, you have to go through it and just check to make sure that nothing breaks down when you try to drop that assumption.
So I was surprised that you seem to have one, I think you have one set of equations that works for all D and you're just looking at points over different fields. Was that correct? Or it's different equations for each D?
So it's the same equation.
Like the same
equations that work for all D, but you interpret it in different fields depending
on
different D.
But I mean, you start with one scheme and you're looking for its points over the different.
Yeah, so the idea is that like if you fix a D, then, so for any fixed D, you're interpreting them over a field. So you can use like classical algebraic geometry for that. But if you want to do one calculation of the concerning the radical ideals that's going to work for all D, then you have to interpret your equation over not a field but a ring, which is Z with 1/2 over
sure.
So that's where you have to introduce like theory of schemes.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Is there anybody online with a question? I have more questions, but I'll ask you later.
Cool, okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thanks again.